Please be aware that this podcast has reference to drug and alcohol use and paraphernalia and may not be appropriate for some people in early recovery. Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Mahjubeen Islam.
And I am Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And we want to thank you for listening to our Treat Addiction podcast. The information in this podcast cannot replace your seeking a treatment provider, which you can easily do at SAMHSA's National Helpline at findtreatment.gov or 1-800-622-4357. This episode, like the others, will talk about the ravages of addiction, but I really want our listeners to concentrate on two words and keep it like a refrain whenever you think of addiction, which is, or are, that treatment works.
In your practice of addiction, which substance use disorder do you treat the most?
So even though I treat all sorts of addictions, by far and away, it's opioid use disorder that dominates. I still remember in the late 80s and early 90s, we were primarily treating alcohol and cocaine use disorder, but things changed in the first wave of the opioid epidemic, which began in 1996 when Purdue Pharma began the manufacture of OxyContin. So the generic of OxyContin is oxycodone, and just to give you a little perspective, a commonly used medication is Percocet, which has 5 or maximally 10 milligrams of oxycodone in it. But when OxyContin was developed and patented by Purdue Pharma, it was available in 10, 20, 40, and 80 milligram tablets. And then listen to this. In July of 2000, a 160 milligram tablet became available. And actually, this is really funny. I remember the Purdue Pharma rep would come to my office all the time. He would always wear a trench coat, and I used to call him Sherlock Holmes. And he would argue because he would tell me to prescribe OxyContin and I would not.
And that's about when the problem began, isn't it?
Yeah, actually it was. Like we mentioned in the previous episode, physicians were taught pharmacology in medical school. And I remember the book clearly stating that opioids were addicting and sudden cessation caused withdrawal, which basically tells you that a medication
right.
or a drug is addicting.
Right.
But that infamous letter in the New England Journal of Medicine that opioids were not addicting was grabbed onto by the Sackler family, which owned Purdue Pharma, and they marketed OxyContin as though it was entirely harmless.
And, you know, I think as physicians, we should also accept that we played a role in this fiasco and made this an iatrogenic disease, which means that it's created by medicine itself. And sadly, while the medical system has a role in the creation of the opioid epidemic, Mahjubeen, don't you agree that the medical system also monetized treatment in a very sad way with the pill mills? Because one of my patients, I remember, attested to the fact that one of her prescribers demanded sexual favors in exchange for prescriptions.
I do remember that. And it when my patients told me about it, it was just like so sad and so stunning that a physician would take advantage of patients in that way.
You were also telling me about a local physician who was prescribing a lot of OxyContin.
Oh, for sure. And like many OxyContin pill mills across the country, his office, too, had patients wrapped around the building in double rows. So get a visual of that. I remember doing rounds in the hospital one day and seeing a 21-year-old female, I'll never forget this, who had taken so much OxyContin that was prescribed by this particular physician that she was too intoxicated to eat or drink, and she developed renal failure, kidney failure, and was condemned to dialysis for life at age 21. Do you remember the other practice at that time that was just across the border in Michigan?
I do. And unfortunately, Ohio was one of the areas hardest hit by this epidemic, including West Virginia and New Hampshire. And I remember reading an article years ago about a small town in Ohio that they had the office was in a strip mall, and the patient line went all the way around.
Yeah, typical.
Yeah, very typical. I think the way it transacted was patients would come in, and they would stand in line, pay their cash, you know, amount and get a prescription in return. And when I started treating opioid addiction myself, one of my patients recalled that she used to come to my building in the days when it was one of the pill mills.
Oh my God, Ketley, this is unbelievable. Because the doctor that I was talking about who prescribed to the 21-year-old who got kidney failure, he's the one. He was in your building?
He was in my building. He was in my building. And I could not. And when I read an article about him and ensuing articles, it was incredible. Because in my mind, I can't even imagine why a person would take such a risk, not only of hurting people, but also of getting caught and being incarcerated and losing your license and all the ensuing problems. But they do.
So in the first wave, it was all kinds of painkillers. And it is with sadness that I remember that there was this young man came to the methadone clinic. And, you know, we always get the history. And he told me that he was 14 years old and he had a little pain in his knee, a little pain in his knee. So he went to his family physician who prescribed him Percocet at age 14. And he said that he had this intense high. And after that, he was entirely addicted. So I saw him like when he was in his like late teens, but it is basically a lifetime of opioid use disorder then. So wave one was of painkillers in the early 90s. And then wave two was of heroin around 2010. So why do you think wave two happened?
Well, I remember that the DEA got very aggressive in their efforts to stemming the tide that made it easy to prescribe these medications. And I also remember we talked about this last time that Purdue Pharmacy had to change the formulation of OxyContin so that it could not become a liquid when it was heated. And that gave heroin its platform. And in a demand and supply economy, it took off. But recently, it's been replaced by the more powerful fentanyl. And again, opioid overdoses have skyrocketed.
Absolutely. And, you know, when a patient comes to my office for the first time, I always ask them when we take the history about what started their addiction, whether it was recreational pain or prescribed. And when you say that this is an iatrogenic disease or created by medicine, 8 out of 10 patients say that it was prescribed. So sad.
It is very sad. And one of the patients I will illustrate shows clearly how it can happen. In the early 2000s, this gentleman had an operation on his hand, and he was prescribed Percocet 5 milligrams, and he clearly remembers the intense high that 5 milligram gave him. When his prescription ran out, he would get into his father's Vicodin. And it wasn't so obvious or bad in the beginning, but as the months went on, he went on vacation and forgot to take the opioids with him, and he had an intense withdrawal from it. On his return home, he began using more and more, to the tune of 80 to 100 pills
a
day.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine?
Wow.
And when you think you didn't hear clearly, you heard clearly. He said 80 to 100 pills a day.
And, you know, this illustrates the development of tolerance that happens with opioids and other addictive substances. And that he was able to tolerate 80 to 100 pills in a day, because someone who is what we call opioid naive, or someone who has not taken opioids, that would be immediate death.
And, you know, I remember that coming to the office with his father, and still today remembering the old days, he's very, very shamed and expresses regret that this changed his life. Even though he's steadily sober now, the addiction robs people of not only finance, but family and friends and autonomy, that loss of self-control. It's also about the drug just taking over every aspect of their lives.
Indeed, it becomes their complete focus. But your patient was fortunate, because he went into treatment at that point, but there are many who go from painkillers to heroin and fentanyl, and then the stakes get really, really high. With heroin, the common use is 1 to 2 grams per day, and it is not always intravenous. Many a time people snort it because they hate injections. But in any disease, you always have the outliers, and I remember a woman who was, and speaking of your 80 to 100 pills guy, I had a patient who said that she was using 4 grams of heroin a day. And I remember looking up from my computer and you know, like quite shocked. And she, with more questioning, she was right. She was, you know, using 4 grams a day, which is just enormous.
I was just thinking of a number of individuals. They would come in and even in their seeking treatment for their addiction, they would sometimes magnify their amount of use so they can get more Suboxone.
Yes.
You know, so you were never quite sure how much they really use sometimes because it's, they thought if I say I use more, they'll give me more of this.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, which is also correct.
It, you know, you say 1 to 2 grams of heroin is high enough. And if it is very pure or if it's mixed with fentanyl, it is easy to overdose and die.
And people don't realize this in their addiction, sadly. I think it's important to kind of like give people an idea as to what mild, moderate, and severe use is. So in mild opioid use disorder or opioid addiction, people are taking about 2 to 4 Percocet a day. And in moderate, they may be taking 5 to 10 Percocet a day or 0.5 gram of heroin. But in severe opioid use disorder, people use over 40 pills of Percocet like your guy, or they snort or inject 2 to 4 grams of heroin per day. We get very concerned, though, when people mix drugs and use opioids with what we call benzodiazepines like Valium, Xanax, Klonopin, or Ativan, because both of them, opioids and these kinds of medications, the benzodiazepines, depress the respiratory center in the brain, and a person can die easily when these are mixed.
And sadly, something just popped into my mind. Even in treatment, I had one individual, she came from another treatment program. She was on Suboxone and Xanax and Adderall.
So that tells you the addiction within the brain is so strong that they are on all these. And you know, when you look at coroner's reports about opioid overdose deaths, it is, you can have them alone, just opioids alone, but frequently they are mixed with benzodiazepines, which, you know, sort of essentially make the death an inevitability because they are so powerful together.
You know, I've seen over the years that it's incredible to me how this plays out. Your total focus. We mentioned this woman and her mother who would daily collect cans and take it to Michigan. Your whole focus is on getting the next high. Forget friends, forget family, forget fun activities. It's just about getting high. And not only that cost, but imagine the financial cost for them having to scrounge daily trying to get money to sustain this.
And like we talked about in our previous episode, that we're trying to promote and have people understand that addiction is a chronic disease. But because it involves money and the entire focus is on getting your next dose, it becomes very difficult to convince people because there is a lot of escalating family conflict because the funds are being drained so fast. And it also kind of illustrates the definition of addiction, which is a chronic relapsing disorder characterized by compulsive drug use despite adverse consequences. So the addicted patient knows that the consequences are not good. But because the addiction has sadly developed, they keep going.
They keep going, and they will risk anything for that next high. Can you always spot someone who has an opioid addiction?
Oh, no. Contrary to what people might think, and like we mentioned in one of our previous episodes, opioid addiction is so common now that you can have very high-functioning people in very good jobs addicted to opioids, but able to hide it because, like your patient, they are taking steadily more and more doses just to keep the withdrawal away. Perhaps what people generally think of when they think of addicted patients, and it's a slur, and I really persuade people not to call people addicts because it is a disease. So I always use addicted patient or an addicted individual. But what people generally have this idea of is when the patient injects heroin or fentanyl, and at that point you can see them nodding and being very sedated, and sadly if the dose is very high, death does occur. I've also seen the very serious consequence of injecting opioids in people getting inflammation of the heart or kidney failure, and abscesses or collections of pus can form under the skin or different parts of the body. But the patients with addiction, there's another little attribute that they have, and that attribute is that they are very innovative and they are master concealers.
Absolutely.
So you can completely miss someone who is in the throes of active addiction.
You know, in spite of the last 5 to 10 years of the aggressive approach to treating addiction, I think it was it this week I was listening to NPR radio and they were talking about what they're doing in Oregon. But I was picturing one of the things the speaker was saying, that some of these individuals are nodding off in the street and on the subway. They have needles all over the floor, and they're trying to rein them in and try to provide treatment. But until a person is really ready.
Correct.
Until they're ready, you're just putting a Band-Aid on it. Until they're very much ready, they will not get treatment. We also have another epidemic going along with this opioid epidemic, don't we?
Yeah, and it is a very it's a silent epidemic because it doesn't have any symptoms, and that's the epidemic of hepatitis C. Because once the addiction is severe, the person throws caution to the winds and they use infected needles. So you have the transmission of hepatitis B and HIV. But with hepatitis C, it's so rampant, it's so much of an epidemic, and it is the highest reason for liver failure and the need for transplants. But the good news is, and you know, what I love about the treatment of addiction is that we definitely have more than the silver lining. And that is that if a person is in sobriety for 6 months, we refer them for hepatitis C treatment, and with the advances in modern medicine, the person is cured, which is, you know, delightful.
It's awesome. It's really awesome. But the addicted individual's lifestyle also makes them more prone to other health problems, doesn't it?
And like, exactly, because they throw caution to the winds, and it's a matter of getting, you know, the next dose and arranging for it. So the lifestyle also changes. So in our initial evaluation, we check for other acute or chronic diseases, like obviously hepatitis B and C, but also tuberculosis and the recent surge in syphilis.
I see the signs as I drive down Detroit Avenue.
Right.
Yeah. See it. It's sad that society doesn't realize that the addicted individual is not having a good time anymore, and that often they continue to use not only to stave off withdrawal symptoms, but just to feel normal.
Right.
And though people may not die from the withdrawal symptoms, some of them actually wish they would die because it is awful.
The severe withdrawal,
yes,
is so bad.
It's awful.
And like and in a previous episode, I don't know why it's always stayed in my mind that the patient said that he felt that every bone in his body was breaking. Mm-hmm. That really is severe withdrawal.
Yeah. And I didn't know this. Someone mentioned to me that the term kicking the habit comes from the person who's writhing in agony and just stretching their legs trying to get comfortable. That's where kicking the habit comes from.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah, like cold turkey comes from opioid use, opioid withdrawal.
Yeah,
because the person is cold and clammy and has goosebumps. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But with all chronic diseases, you have, like diabetes also, you have the mild, moderate, or severe. It can be mild when people are able to quit opioids themselves, and they have some cold turkey type symptoms, but they do fine. It is usually moderate to severe opioid withdrawal that requires treatment. And while opioid withdrawal doesn't kill people, for some it's very, very severe, like we talked about. And in opioid withdrawal, the patient has intense restlessness. They're cold, clammy, goosebumps, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and muscle and bone pain. But the good news is that whether opioid withdrawal is moderate or severe, we are able to institute a treatment plan, and patients do very well and have sustained sobriety. And I tell them that I want you to come into treatment, which we will talk about more in the future episodes, in full withdrawal. So when we institute treatment, it feels like heaven.
It does. It does. And we can even, you know, until or in the midst of treating them with meds, give them other things to help them with the insomnia, the muscle aches,
exactly,
the nausea, the
yes,
vomiting.
Yes.
We can treat all of those symptoms. I know we're going to go into the many ways that treatment is effective, but perhaps we should talk a little bit about the opioids themselves.
Yeah, I think it's important to explain what opioids are. So during wave one, people were very into OxyContin, Percocet, and Vicodin, which is hydrocodone, and also into methadone. In wave two, which continues to quite a degree, it is mainly heroin and fentanyl.
And how are these used often?
Like we discussed in the last episode, the high depends on the rapidity with which the drug reaches the brain. So intravenous use causes the highest high, followed by inhalation, which is smoking, snorting, or vaping, and then use by mouth.
And so what are some of the effects of the opioids?
There can be profound pain relief, and that's why people will say that it was prescribed. And that's a lot of times for the example also that you gave for pain relief. But they also cause sedation, respiratory depression, euphoria, which is the high, a slowed heart rate, constipation, and as we mentioned, dependence.
And there are different ways that opioids act, right?
Yeah, and this is a little bit slightly heavy to kind of like understand, but I think it's important too, so that we can understand the various treatments. So we have what we call agonists, and these opioids have full activity at the mu receptor. And the examples of these are methadone, morphine, heroin, hydrocodone, and fentanyl. And as their dose increases, their effect on the pain also increases.
Then we have the partial agonist. And these opioids have partial activity at these receptors and have what they call a ceiling effect, in that the effect on pain does not increase with an increase in the dose. So an example of that would be buprenorphine, better known as Suboxone. This property is used for treatment of the opioid addiction because there's only so much they can take to get that which they're seeking, that
exactly.
Euphoria.
Exactly. And the last group are antagonists, and they block or antagonize the mu receptor. And again, this helps in treatment. And the examples are naloxone and naltrexone. Naloxone is used in overdoses. People know it as Narcan. And we will be talking about naltrexone, also known as Vivitrol injectable, in a future episode.
And so this is a good segue into the treatment of opioid use disorder, which we will save with bated breath until our next episode.
So I want to thank my co-host, Dr. Ketley Daniels, for a great conversation today. I'm your host and producer, Dr. Mahjabeen Islam.
And I am your co-host, Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And our executive producer extraordinaire is Chris Pfeiffer. If you have questions or comments, or you just want to listen again, please go to wgte.org/treataddiction or wherever you stream your podcasts. And until the next episode, do remember, patience in difficult times and gratitude always.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.